There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Well, first of all, we must, as disciples of Jesus Christ, know the mind of Christ. You need to be cultivating the mind of Christ on the matters of the day by saturating your life in the Word of God. If you are not in the Word, then you need to not be paying attention and reading other words, right? We need to be in the Word first. And out of the Word, we will then cultivate the mind of Christ on the matters of the day, and we will then be equipped with the Holy Spirit's attendance in our lives to actually speak authentically as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ in the midst of the world today. Otherwise, we really need to not be speaking into the matters of the world. The world is confused enough. We don't need to be contributing to that. We need to be people who, as ambassadors of the kingdom of God, are bringing that eternal reality to bear on the temporal realities of our day. And so that's what we're going to try to help you do here today, reconnect the eternal with the everyday, bring the Christian worldview to bear on the headlines of the day. If you'd like some equipping resources on that, we've got some for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can always like us on Facebook. We appreciate that. That's also a great place to post comments and offer feedback. And you can always communicate with me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, I'm going to lead off today with a little D.C. action, what's going on in D.C. Maybe not the things that are top of mind in terms of, scandal and intrigue, but things that should be top of mind in terms of those of us who are concerned about pro-life issues. So the District of Columbia, which is the city in which our federal government lives and breathes and finds its being, the District of Columbia does not have congressional representation because the District of Columbia, it's a city, but it's not in a state, and so it doesn't have representatives in Congress. What it does have since 1973 is something called the Home Rule Act. It almost sounds like a baseball term, but it's not. The Home Rule Act. So in 1973, Congress sort of broadened the city's ability to govern itself. Now that government is limited, and Congress did reserve the authority to intervene when it viewed actions of the District of Columbia to be improper in any way. So that's the context of the conversation that we're having today related to the District of Columbia's assisted suicide law, which goes into effect on Saturday. We've talked about this when the City Council of D.C. was debating this assisted suicide bill. We talked about it here on The Reconnect. And we talked about all of the issues that are raised by the whole right to die or dignity in death or dying with dignity movement across the United States. We certainly touched on this in our conversation with Johnny Erickson Tata when she was on the show. We talked about this because there are disability advocates who are very much in opposition to these assisted suicide legislations, laws across the country, because they view themselves as targets of it. Okay. And so this is, if you are a pro-life person, we need to not just be pro-life for the pre-born, right? We need to be pro-life for all of life and for every life. And so the assisted suicide conversation is a pro-life conversation. And so it's one we need to be equipped to have. So in a rare step, a House committee, House of Representatives committee, voted 22-14 on Monday night to block the implementation of D.C.'s Death with Dignity law. But in order for that to actually have any impact or effect, the full House and the full Senate will both need to take this up and vote on it by Friday, because on Friday, the 30-day window for congressional review expires, and both the full House and the full Senate would have to vote to block the implementation of this law by this coming Friday. So I don't know how realistic it is at this point that both the House and the Senate would take a vote on these measures, but let me bring you up to speed on the conversations that took place in this House committee on Monday that led to the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform to vote 22-14 to block the implementation of DC's assisted suicide law. Now, interestingly, at the same time that this vote was taking place, this debate and vote was taking place in the Congress, there was a group called Hands Off DC, which was holding a brainstorming session down the street to how to keep Congress's hands off of DC in relationship to this and other matters. And I, of course, would like to march around in their context with a Funds Off DC sign, reminding them that the District of Columbia is what it is because our federal government and all of our federal tax dollars swarm around there so frequently. I mean, there's a reason that Washington, D.C. has not experienced the kind of recession and backing up in the last 8 years that the rest of America has experienced. And it's because there's a lot of money in D.C., a lot of money. And all of that money wouldn't be there, frankly, if the federal government was constantly told to keep its, quote, hands off of D.C. The whole reason D.C. is what it is because the federal government's hands are all over it. Okay, that's another subject. Representative Jason Chaffetz, Republican from Utah, is the chairman of the House Oversight Committee. And he is the one who really, I would say, has intensely led his committee to both debate and then finally vote upon the blocking of this law. Chaffetz is a Mormon. He singled out the district's law, which allows doctors to prescribe fatal doses of medication to terminally ill patients, and he singled it out as a moral issue. Here's what he said. He said, "My opposition to the law stems from deep personal moral conviction." Now, what do you suppose that deep personal moral conviction is? Well, it's a conviction of faith. We're talking here about the conviction of faith. He said, I didn't ask for this to come to me, which he's saying, you know, I didn't provoke this legislation. But he does worry that it's going to create a marketplace for death. He says our country should never facilitate, encourage, or tacitly accept measures that prematurely end the lives of its people. Now, that is a pro-life statement, if I've ever heard one. Let me read it again. Our country should never facilitate, encourage, nor tacitly accept measures that prematurely end the lives of its people. When you think of the premature ending of life, what comes to mind? Maybe not the death with dignity law in D.C., but certainly the issue of abortion nationwide. All right, so this is definitely going to be something to watch. This is going to be something to pay attention to in just the coming days. If you have a desire to influence either your congressman or your senator in relationship to this and encourage them to get this action in front of both the House and the Senate before Friday in order that DC's Death with Dignity law might be blocked from implementation, then I would encourage you to do so. There's a short window of opportunity on that particular issue. The House did pass legislation last year related to something that I would say is related to this subject, and it's the question of whether or not doctors and other medical professionals can be compelled to participate in or facilitate abortion. So again, this is when we talk about life issues. Sometimes we're talking about life issues on the front end of life, in terms of birth. Sometimes we're talking about life issues on the end of life concerns. And there are a handful of states that not only abortion's legal in all 50 states because of Roe v. Wade, it's not as rampant or used as often in some states as others. It's not paid for by by taxpayer dollars in most places. But in states like California, you get the state intervening. So in 2014, the state of California ordered that all health insurance plans cover elective abortions, and they provided no exceptions for religious employers. New York State issued a similar mandate in 2015 as well. So, you know, the challenge that you have here is that you do have the state stomping all over people of religious conscience, people whose religious conscience or religiously informed conscience would prohibit them from participating in an elective abortion. And so there is an effort underway to have Congress pass a bill that would protect doctors and other medical professionals who refuse to perform abortions due to their faith. So people who want to object to participating in an elective abortion procedure because of their faith, this act of Congress would protect those professionals, those medical professionals. So it's called the Conscience Protection Act of 2017. The Conscience Protection Act is sponsored by Representative Dianne Black, Republican from Tennessee. She's one of the sponsors of the legislation in the House. And she basically said, being an American has always meant experiencing the freedom to live by the dictates of one's own deeply held beliefs, and to do so at home, at work, and in the public square. Now, that is a strong statement, a strong articulation or rearticulation of the clause in the Constitution that protects the free exercise of religion. Remember, we are not guaranteed the freedom to worship. We are guaranteed the free exercise of our religion, whatever it may be or not be. And so what Representative Black is affirming here, not only in what she is saying, but what she is affirming in her co-sponsorship of this legislation, which is called the Conscience Protection Act of 2017, she's affirming that it's not government's role to tell people what to believe, and it's also not government's role to compel people to do things that are contrary to their religious conscience. And so that's essentially what the Conscience Protection Act of 2017 would ensure. It would create additional protections for healthcare providers who do not perform elective abortions due to their religious beliefs, and it would protect religious employers who choose not to cover elective abortion procedures in their health insurance plans. Now, you are going to hear a lot about health insurance plans in the coming days. If you're not alert to sort of what's happening right now with the efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare, trust me when I tell you, it's top of news in some places. It's certainly top of concern for people whose insurance rates have risen, well, in some cases, more than 100% since the implementation of the quote-unquote Affordable Care Act. And so these conversations are all related. And I'm trying to get you to see the connections and connect the dots between different pieces of news that appear to be about very different things. One appears to be about assisted suicide. One appears to be about protecting doctors and other healthcare providers from not having to have their conscience invaded and stomped all over by the government requiring them to participate in elective abortions. And the other is going to be related to insurance and health insurance. Okay, all of that is related, and it's related at this issue of conscience, freedom of conscience, particularly the freedom of a religiously informed conscience. And so that is always a conversation that you could invite yourself into with another person. It's one thing for someone to argue that a woman has the freedom to choose to have an elective abortion. And that's a debate that we are going to continue to have in our culture. Would the person who is defending the woman's right to freely choose to have an abortion also defend a doctor's right to not participate in an elective abortion because of their religious conscience? Because if you're only going to defend freedom of choice on one end of that conversation, and you're not going to defend freedom of choice on the other end of the conversation, I don't know what worldview you are arguing out of, other than just the culture of death. This is a conversation that is going to be loom large in our national conversation, because as soon as we start talking about protecting religious people from having to do something that non-religious people think is not a question, abortion. And when we talk about placing protections in the law for religious employers to not cover certain procedures that some people view as a part of comprehensive women's health care, we are going to find ourselves in a culture war in the coming weeks and months over these issues. And so you and I have to be prepared to have these conversations. What is conscience? What does it mean for my conscience to be religiously informed? What does it mean for me to be a person who actively invites the Holy Spirit to have Jesus Christ take every thought captive? That's the conformity of my conscience to the mind of Christ. And if I'm going to have if I'm going to be a person who has a Christ-conformed conscience, then I am not going to be participating in elective abortions. And I'm not going to be forcing other people of religious conviction to participate in elective abortions either. I'm going to defend the freedom of conscience on this point. All right. We are going to talk a lot this year, unfortunately. I'm just going to go ahead and project. We're going to talk a lot this year about the threat to Christian professionals, the threats to their accreditation, their licensing, their jobs on this issue of religious conscience. All right. Tomorrow, this would be the appropriate time in the show for the drum roll, if you had one. If you are a person that, you know, does a little drum roll, don't take both hands off the steering wheel in order to do it. Okay, you got a little drum roll. Tomorrow, you are going to be able to buy an American Girl doll that's a boy. That was my big lead-in headline for you. Okay, here's, I know, if you didn't already know this, there's a boy in the American Girl lineup, and he shows up tomorrow. His name is Logan. But let me back up. The concept behind American Girl dolls. You got to go back quite a ways, actually. You got to go back quite a distance to remember what the American Girl doll was really all about. The American Girl doll has changed a lot since Mattel bought what was then the Pleasant Company in 1998. So the Pleasant Company conceived of the American Girl doll and produced the American Girl dolls in order to introduce little girls to history, to expand their understanding of historic events. So the American Girl dolls represented periods of history like the American Revolution or the period of slavery. They represented realities like homelessness during the Great Depression, being Jewish in America during the Second World War. Each and every American Girl doll was an individual who faced a significant challenge, and their stories taught loyalty, friendship, bravery, all kinds of great character qualities. Now, these historic characters were eventually, under Mattel's ownership, archived. I don't know if you've ever been archived, but that's not a positive thing to be, right? If you're a person, you know, you actively engage in something and somebody archives you, that's not good. All right, it was more than being shelved. You literally couldn't buy them for a period of time. All right, so why? Well, because they wanted to go with this concept of girl of the year, designing your own doll to look like you. So the girl of the year still comes with a story, which is much of what made the American Girl dolls distinctive in the first place, but they don't come with the same kind of story. So they come with a story that's made up and it's not helping little girls empathize with somebody whose experience is vastly different than theirs, even though they are similar in that they're the same age and that they're little girls who are American. So girls are now missing out by not reading about the lives of, let's say, Addie, the slave girl who escaped north with her mom. they're not comprehending what it was like to be a Native American girl when the Native American tribes were overrun by European immigrants, right? So you miss out on the empathy that develops by getting to know another little girl in American history who is like you in that she's a girl, but her life experience is very different than yours. Instead, what we have now are American girl dolls that are just like you. It's like a mini-me version. So introduce, come into that, bring into that conversation a boy. Now, I have to tell you that from my perspective, having a boy is not a bad thing. So the announcement, like on the Today website, the big announcement is, it's a boy. American Girl announces release of first male doll. Well, he might be the first male doll, but he won't be the first American Girl doll to be dressed up as a boy. Apparently, creative moms have, for a number of years now, been making boy clothes to fit the 18-inch girl dolls because, you know what? People have wanted there to be boys with the girls for a long time because, you know what? Boys and girls like each other. And when little girls are making up stories for their American Girl dolls that are, by the way, just like them, guess what they want that mini-me to have? They want that mini-me to have a boy who is a friend, also known as a boyfriend. Okay, so now there are apparently other moms out there who have boys who want dolls who look, oh, guess what? Just like them. And so what Mattel is saying is that they have seen a rising interest in male dolls in recent years, with creative moms transforming the 18-inch girl dolls into boys for their sons. This is an increasing demand that has led the company to create Logan. Here's the good news and the bad news. Wherever you stand on the whole boys playing with dolls issue, at least boys want boy dolls. At least boys want dolls that are like them. In this case, at least girls want their girl dolls to have boyfriends. So before we get all hysterical about the fact that American Girl is now going to have boy dolls, because I don't think that Logan will be a bachelor all by himself with all these bachelorettes for long, I imagine there will be other boys to follow in a full range of diversity, much like there is now a full range of diversity of American girl dolls. I think that the idea of giving girls a boy to be with their American girl doll who's just like them, from a Christian worldview perspective, is not a bad thing. So, before we get hysterical over the fact that American Girl product line is now going to have a boy, maybe those of us who advocate for the preservation and celebration of male-female relationships and marriage should be celebrating the move to give kids the option of imagining their American girls to be in relationship with, well, American boys. I gotta tell you, Barbie was made better by Ken. She was less concerned about herself and more concerned about relationship with another. I think that Tenny will be better because of Logan. Tenny, by the way, also appears tomorrow in the American Girl lineup. Hi, Faye. Give us more boys. Lest all the American girls fight among themselves for Logan's time and attention. After all, he's going to be the only boy in the mix until the American Girl Doll Company comes up with another one. All right, friends, I am sure you have feedback about that. I would love to hear it. You can always give me your feedback on the text line for listeners at 877-655-6755. You can give me your feedback on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. You can give me your feedback on Facebook. We're at The Reconnect. This is the month of love. This is also the month of the Kindness Challenge. So if you have not signed up for the Kindness Challenge yet, it's not too late. Go to reconnectwithcarmen.com. Look at the big banner ad for the 30-day Kindness Challenge and join us as we are seeking to cultivate the spiritual fruit of kindness in our lives during this month. All right, folks, we got lots of resources available for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com. We're going to take a break and then we'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Reconnect with your host, Carmen LaBurge. Now, back to Carmen.
All right, friends, I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we are talking about what people are talking about, seeking to equip you to be the ambassador of the kingdom of God that he has called you to be. I invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. Let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, you have heard the voice of our next guest before. It is Juliana Tamaruzzi. She is the founder of the Iraqi Christian Relief Council. She's a senior fellow at the Philos Project. You can follow them on Twitter at Philos Project or at Iraqi Christian. You can also find information about what we're talking about today at IraqiChristianRelief.org. Juliana, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Hi, Carmen. Thank you for having me on again.
Absolutely. Okay, so bring us up to date on realities for Assyrian Christians in the Middle East. It's been a couple of months since we have talked with you. Tell us what has happened and what is happening now.
Sure. The Nineveh Plain, which is our ancestral homeland, has been liberated. Unfortunately, it is being protected by the Peshmerga, the Kurdish Peshmerga, and the Iraqi Special Forces. We still don't have entirely the right to protect ourselves because the number of our soldiers is low due to lack of training and lack of fighting equipment that they're suffering from. We still are not able to defend ourselves as we want to. There are 3,000 Christian militia members that are or volunteers that want to protect the region. The Nineveh Plain, however, were unable to be trained at this time. There have been a few families that have been moved back, I'm happy to say. There has been one family of the Nineveh Plain Protection Unit fighter that has gone back to a town called Berbede. That was about 60,000 Christians that had lived there. They were forced out by the Islamic State, so that's the good news. The other good news is more families are returning to a town which we, as Iraqi Christian Relief Council, have adopted to help rebuild it, and it's called Telescope. There have been about 5 to 7 families that have been moved back. The challenge there is the infrastructure is gone. So we just sent some money to help rebuild the water infrastructure to help them start resuming semi-normal life in Telescope. But the electricity is gone. The generators have been taken away and destroyed. So this is what we're doing. We're doing all of this work under a new project called Operation Return to Nineveh.
All right. So Operation Return to Nineveh is the information that people will want to be tracking. Tell us about the progress of, if there is any, the progress of protecting. Creating and protecting a homeland in the Nineveh Plain. I know this is a conversation that has been happening on Capitol Hill. Can you tell us, give us some progress on that?
Sure. With the new administration, with President Trump's administration, we are more hopeful than ever that we have a person in the White House that Congress is going to start paying more attention to this. Because for the first time, Carmen, on a united front, we as the Assyrian Christians, also known as Chaldean and Syriac, along with the Yazidis and Turkmen and Shabaks, which are the who are the other minorities affected by ISIS, we are coming forward on a united front for the first time, asking for this province to be created not only for Christians, but also for the Shabaks, the Turkmen, and the Yazidis as well, and. We are hopeful. We are hopeful that we have more friends than ever before in this administration.
Okay, so Juliana, this is information that you are steeped in and language that rolls off your tongue quite easily. So can you, for our listeners, go through that list? Because you talk about Assyrian Christians and you also refer to them as Chaldean. And then you list other religious minorities who are like the Christians in the region, experiencing persecution under ISIS. So can you just differentiate briefly between Assyrian and Chaldean and Turkmen and Yazidi and others who you mentioned? That would be helpful to us to understand the context of this conversation.
Sure, absolutely. So the Assyrians, it is really our ethnicity. So the Christians of Iraq are ethnically Assyrian. We're divided by our denominational name. So I myself, I'm baptized Catholic of the Eastern Rite, which means Chaldean. So those people who follow the Catholic faith are referred to by the Vatican as Chaldean. So that's the difference. But ethnically, we're all the same people. And we are brothers and sisters in Christ, the Assyrians and the Chaldeans. And ethnically, we're Assyrian. The Yazidis are, Yazidi religion is a closed religion. And by ethnicity, they're also Yazidis. People cannot marry into the religion. They cannot marry out of the religion. So it's a closed religion. It has elements of Zoroastrian faith, which is an ancient Persian faith. It has some element of Islam and element of Christianity in there as well. And they have been completely devastated. If you recall, if your listeners recall those people that were trapped on the mountains in Sinjar in August of 2014, those were mainly Yazidis. Many Yazidis, thousands of Yazidi women have been kidnapped and have been sold in sex slavery. The other group, the Turkmen Shiites, so the Turkmen are descendants of Turkish people, and they're Muslim, and they break into two, the Shiites and the Sunni faction, and they have lived peacefully along our side and alongside of the Yazidis for centuries. They've lived mainly in Tal Afar, which is in the northern part of Iraq, right next to the Yazidis, and right next to the Christian Assyrians that we've lived in the Nineveh Plain for centuries. So Iraq, in short, Carmen, Iraq used to be a beautiful mosaic, multi-ethnic, multi-religious country or region. And unfortunately, it has fallen into really very much a sectarian place. It has fallen into the hands of the Islamist extremists. And we're trying to, by bringing these minority groups together on a united front, we're trying to recreate that beautiful mosaic which Iraq once was.
So I don't think that message is getting out, because I think it's my perception that Westerners view the protection of religious minorities, particularly Christians, as seeking to... as be sectarian. So I do think, Juliana, that what you are sharing with us, and particularly the description of the Nineveh Plain, this protected region that is conceived of right now in the heart and mind, it exists on the ground, but it does not yet exist in terms of a protected space for the return of all of these diverse religious minorities to recreate this Iraqi mosaic of religious and ethnic pluralism. I don't think that message is yet piercing the hearts and minds of folks in a position to make something happen. So I really appreciate you're taking the time to walk us through the distinctives, and then also to be able to say, look, what is imagined here is a recreation of what was before we had this virulent version of Islam in the form of the Islamic State, which is targeting and persecuting to the point of genocide Assyrian Christians, Chaldean Christians, the Turkmen and the Yazidis in this region. So that is a beautiful and particularly helpful description of what was and the hope for what can be restored. I would love for you to maybe in the context of that same conversation, when people talk about the U.S. refugee policy that's in place right now, this question about whether or not preference should be given to religious minorities from particular regions, can you, just from your perspective, I know your interest is not to get too political in this conversation, so I'm not asking you to do that, but from your perspective, can you help us understand what a religious minority from the Middle East, what that actually looks like, what the life of that person is like.
You know, Carmen, this really affects me personally as well, because my uncle, who is an Iranian citizen with a green card, when this ban was rolled out, we weren't sure if he were to come to the States or not. But now, since it's been all rectified and he is on his way here, he's an Assyrian Christian born in Iran. So for me, as an American citizen, I'm not politically correct. I think you know me by now, Carmen. I'm a fan of this ban because we have to be very careful with whom we allow to this country. And let me say this, that there are a lot, the reports have it that there are a lot of Muslims who are scrambling to find fake paperwork, fake baptismal paperwork, to pass themselves as Christians to be able to be allowed into the United States. A minority who lives in the Middle East, in the Islamic countries, they are subjected to the Sharia law. I was born and raised in Iran, and I had to abide by the Sharia law. I had to cover my hair, my legs, my arms. I couldn't wear my clothes out in the open. So I, as a free human being, was able to choose, and I was blessed to be able to be accepted into the United States 27 years ago. So personally, those who want to leave the Middle East, I believe as free humans, should be allowed to leave. However, it's a double-edged sword for me as an activist, because if we open the doors and tell and welcome the Middle Eastern Christians, for example, in this case, yes, they will come here, they will thrive here as Christians. But what is lost is the ethnic aspect. My nieces barely speak Assyrian. They, chances are, will never marry Assyrian men. And their kids will never attest to being Assyrians. So as Christians, we will thrive. But as an ethnic minority group that is already on the verge of extinction, such laws will really melt my ethnic group, and we will be extinct within the next 100 years. So instead of advocating for is, instead of forcing people to leave or really opening the doors for people, making it easy for people to leave, is to invest some of those dollars on the ground, rebuilding their lives on the ground, rebuilding their churches, their homes, because Christianity really, its heart is in the Middle East. And if we take all Christians out of the Middle East, we're really accelerating that region to be a hotbed for Islamic fundamentalism. We are the bridge of understanding between the Islamic East and the Christian West. That's what I'm advocating for on the Hill and here among churchgoers, among the people who occupy the pews in churches. I travel throughout America and talk about this. And I really encourage your listeners to visit our website to see the level of our involvement on the ground and how much work we do on the ground to help these people really return home. A lot of people want to go back home, but they will not go back home unless there's security that is provided to them and economic stability is given back to them and their homes are rebuilt.
Right. I just want people to imagine for a moment. Remind our listeners of the website. It's IraqiChristianRelief.org. That's IraqiChristianRelief.org. I want you just to imagine for a moment, this, you know, my listeners, Juliana, you've seen it firsthand and you know people living this reality. So I want you to imagine that it's not just that your home is gone. It's not just that a fire wiped out your neighborhood. There's no public works system in place. So there's no water treatment plant. There's no electric power grid. There are no power poles. There are no power lines. There is no power distribution system. There's nobody fixing the roads, which have been bombed and destroyed. There's nobody rebuilding bridges. Just on and on and on. And just add to that, there's no school system. There's no healthcare system. There's no system of any kind. So what we're talking about when we're talking about empowering or equipping Assyrian Christians, Chaldean Christians, Turkmen, and Yazidis to return to the Nineveh plain and create there again a home, which has been their homeland for thousands of years. So when we're encouraging this idea of Operation Return to Nineveh, and we're talking about a return to the Nineveh plain, we are also talking about people who are going to return there who are going to need really long-term partnerships in terms of rebuilding the infrastructure and rebuilding their homes and rebuilding their communities and rebuilding their schools and rebuilding hospitals and on and on and on and on. So I want to invite people into this in a couple of ways. First of all, if you go to risevigil.org, risevigil.org, you can get a vigil kit, and it's a great way of inviting your congregation into this conversation through prayer. Prayer is the place we've got to start, and then we've got to add to our prayers provision. And so when you go to IraqiChristianRelief.org, you can see the provision that's being provided through the Iraqi Christian Relief Council. You can see what Juliana's doing. You can contact her directly, and you can become equipped to become a person who can partner with one of these families long-term to equip and empower them to return to the Nineveh Plain and rebuild their culture together. Juliana, anything that you want to add before we go today?
Yes, I just wanted to also thank you for that comment. That was so beautifully said. And I would like to invite all the ministers out there that are listening to this program. If a few churches in your community would come together and adopt one church to help it rebuild, we've also done that legwork. We also have proposals to rebuild the churches. What a beautiful thing it would be if the Western Christians would come to the rescue of the Eastern Church, the church that has defied all the persecution, that has fought, and many have died, and they have become martyrs today, but they have not renounced Christ. And the church bells are starting tolling again. The pastors have gone back trying to rebuild their churches again, but they cannot do that with the whole body of Christ. So you can contact us. We can help you choose a church and help adopt the church and rebuild their community together.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that, Juliana. Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing with us again today on The Reconnect.
Thank you so much, and God bless all of you.
All right, friends. Again, it's IraqiChristianRelief.org. You can get a vigil kit at risevigil.org. All right, it is time to go below the fold. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start or engage with others in conversation, stuff that people might be talking about on social media, stuff that's trending on Facebook or Twitter, and help you bring an eternal perspective into that conversation, where you might introduce eternal principles that might not only change the conversation, but actually change the way a person thinks. And you and I both know if you can change the way a person thinks, or God changes the way they think, their life will follow. So, because we don't like inconsistency, we don't like to be thinking one thing and doing another. We don't like to live as hypocrites. We don't like to live in conflict with, you know, between our thoughts and our actions. So we have a tendency to work in the direction of bringing our behavior into alignment with our thinking. So changing people's thinking is an important step. Okay, so this was viral on Facebook. So I thought I would share it with you, because anything that's viral is something that people are talking about. This is the story of Whitney Cottrell. Whitney Cottrell is a 27-year-old single mom. She works as a hospital housekeeper while she attends school full-time. She's seeking to become a respiratory therapist. And the reason we're talking about Whitney Cottrell today is because she is a single mom who is committed to doing everything that she can to give her two young kids a great childhood full of opportunity. And so here's what basically happened. Her 5-year-old's school was having a, let me get it correct, Dads and Donuts Day. Well, if you're a single mom, what do you not have to send to Dad and Donut Day? You know, you don't have a dad. There's no dad in this particular family system. And in reality, across America, there's a lot of kids who don't have a dad to take to Dad and Donut Day. Well, Whitney Cottrell, wanting to satisfy her child's desire to have a dad at Dad and Donut Day, She came up with a creative solution. Here's Lucas. Lucas insisted that his mom attend. Here's what Lucas said. Lucas is five. He said, "I want you to go. You're my mom and my dad." So taking that into account, Cottrell decided to dress up in the part of a dad. She wore baggy gym shorts, a t-shirt, a baseball cap, and she painted a goatee on her face. Now, I will tell you from the viral picture on Facebook, she still doesn't look like a boy. All right. She definitely looks like a mom dressed up to look like a dad. But the point is this. We in our culture, we as the church in this culture, We need to be helping these families that just have a mom. Because you and I both know kids cannot grow up with one parent who's trying to function as the mom and the dad. That as much as this single young mom wants to be everything to her kids, you and I both know kids need more adults in their life than just the mom. And so I guess this is an appeal today to those of you who are men in particular, who have some time on your hands, who have the capacity to enter into the life of a family that currently just has a mom. And to step up, to step into the kind of incarnational role that Christian men could be providing in our culture and in our society, that boys would have a male mentor from church, or they'd have a male Sunday school teacher. They'd have somebody that on Dad and Donut Day could go to their school with them. You're never going to be their dad. We recognize that. But in order for the church to actually manifest what the family of faith is supposed to be like, I think that there's an opportunity here. Now, first of all, I want to salute and applaud this single mom for doing absolutely what was the right thing for her kid in this situation. And then I also want to take a moment to grieve the reality that we have a lot of kids in our culture who... you know, they're going to be at church on Mother's Day, and they're going to be in the custody of their dad on that day. And you're going to do Mother's Day stuff that is just going to weird them out. And the same is going to be true on Father's Day. When you focus on cultural events and cultural holidays, and you do so in a gender-specific way, you are segregating the witness of the church in a way that's challenging for the complicated realities of American family life today. So, although the ideal, absolutely, we're going to set the ideal out there. But while we're setting the ideal out there of a biological mom and dad who got married before they ever thought about doing that which produces children, and then they had those kids and they've been raising those kids in the context of an intact, healthy nuclear family, and there's generations of other people supporting them, absolutely, that is the ideal. That ideal does not exist for very many kids in our culture today. And so what does it look like to be the church, the household of faith, with God as our Father? What does it look like for the church to be providing an intact, integrated model of multi-generational love with dads and moms in the mix? Regardless of the reality at home, what does it look like for the church to really function as the household of God for kids today? So, again, a shout out to this single mom for what she has done and what she is doing, and a shout out to the church for the men of the church to get off the sidelines of the culture and get into the conversation. Man, we need you at Dad and Donut Day. And we need you in their lives to be the person who they would invite to such an event. All right, friends, we got little time here. This is The Reconnect. Catch up with me online, reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.